Welcome back to Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. So let's get it on it. Let's crank it out. Let's put it out. Let's get into what I'm getting on. And we are going to continue with part two, what I think the best articles of 2019 are. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this part two of the articles that I think are most important, and probably going to have maybe this one, maybe one more. I'm not quite sure. We'll see how it plays out, but let's move on. Let's move on to the next patient that we're seeing in our busy day, and it is a 55-year-old male that comes in with atrial fibrillation. He needs a refill on his anticoagulation medicine and to get a refill or a referral for his knee pain. And now you might be saying to yourself, Andrew, what does this patient, what does this new patient you're talking about have to do with the top articles? Well, that leads me into this article. And this article is, of course, the 2019 AHA ACC HRS focus update from the 2014 AHA ACC HRS guideline for the management of patients with atrial fibrillation. I think there are two really important things in this. Well, there are many things in this guideline that you should be aware of. And if you're not aware of it, you should go read it. But if you have no time to read whatsoever, you're not even aware that these things exist, there are two important everyday clinician recommendations that I think everyone should know. And that is, one, NOACs are recommended over warfarin for NOAC eligible patients. That is anyone that doesn't have valvular AFib. And the guideline is very clear that valvular AFib is moderate to severe mitral stenosis. It is only a stenosis of the valve, a stenosis not of all valves, but only of the mitral valve, moderate to severe mitral stenosis, or a mechanical heart valve. And of course, that makes sense. Mechanical heart valve always is going to be valvular stenosis. So now, out with warfarin, in with the bands and trans, my friends, dabigatran, apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban. These are the first-line therapy for atrial fibrillation. Now, as you can tell, warfarin used to be equal in 2014. In 2014, we used to say warfarin is equal to the bands and trans. We now know it is not equal, which can only make those individuals who really like warfarin and the warfarin medication itself very depressed. And that would make sense, but it is not the only medication that is depressed. Oh, no, no, no. You see, there is one other recommendation here that says, for patients with atrial fibrillation and a CHADS-2 VAS score of 0 in men or 1 in women, it is reasonable to omit anticoagulation. And you might be saying to yourself, Andrew, that sounds a lot like the 2014 recommendation. That sounds almost exactly like the 2014 recommendation, and you would be correct. Except in the 2014 recommendation, they said, with non-valvular atrial fibrillation and CHADS VAS score of 1, then no antithrombotic therapy or treatment with oral anticoagulant or aspirin may be considered. That is right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Aspirin is out of the guidelines. Aspirin no longer indicated. And I'm not going to go through all the evidence here. I'm not going to talk about every single study that's been done, but here's the deal. We know that giving aspirin for those individuals that are low-risk AFib, giving aspirin as an anticoagulant for those individuals that are low-risk actually does more harm than it does good. So your options now are DOACs, your bands and trans, dabigatran, apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban, or if they have valvular AFib, then it's warfarin, or if they're low-risk, a CHADS VAS score of 0 in men or 1 in women, then it is nothing. Nothing, my friends. Nothing at all. But let us not forget, this patient also wants to talk about his knee pain. And luckily for us, there was a paper in the Lancet or Lancet, depending how you want to say it. You say tomato, I say tomato. But it was titled, How Long Does a Knee Replacement Last? A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of Case Series in National Registry Reports with More Than 15 Years of Follow-Up. They took data from large national joint registries, Australia and Finland. They had more than 300,000 knee replacements, and the primary outcome was all-cause survival of the joint. Yes, it was all-cause survival, not of the person, but of the joint, meaning how frequently did they have to go in and redo the joint or fix the joint or take the joint out and put a new one in because you had wore through the joint. And what did they find? Well, they found that 82% of total knee replacements last 25 years and 93% last 15 years. This is important, my friends. This is important because, as the old saying goes, there is no hitch on a hearse. Well, there is no good years left on a knee in a casket either. So if you are thinking about giving your patient a knee replacement, if you're thinking about sending them to an orthopedic surgeon to get a knee replacement, well then, do it sooner than later. Because if I'm your patient, you don't need to give me my first knee replacement at age 80 or even 75, because I'm not going to live to be 100. I'm not going to live to be 105. Give it to me early. Let me enjoy the good years out of my knee while I still can. Now, those exact same authors, as I mentioned, had a huge database from Finland and Australia. And instead of using all this information to publish one paper in the Lancet, they use all that information to publish two papers in the Lancet. Because if there's one thing better than one publication, it's two publications. And the other publication in the Lancet, the exact same issue, the exact same basically set of ink cartridges that were used, was how long does a hip replacement last? A systematic review and meta-analysis of case series and national registry reports with more than 15 years of follow-up. They did the same thing here. They collected all kinds of information from a large joint registry, and then they had more than 200,000, or right about 200,000, hip replacements. The primary outcome was, well, again, all-cause survival of the hip replacement. Again, it wasn't all-cause survival of the patient. It was all-cause survival of the actual joint, the replacement joint that was placed in the individuals. And what did they find about hip replacements? They found that about 90% of hip replacements will last 15 years, 70% will last 20 years, and about 60% will last 25 years. 60% of hip replacements will last 25 years. There is no hitch on a hearse, and there are no good years left in a hip if I'm in a casket. So don't try to spare me time. Don't try to buy me time to the very end. No, give me my hip replacement early, because I'm not going to live to be 100. But my knee or my hip replacement might live to be 100, and it does me no good if I can't use it. But that was only the first patient. Let's talk about a few more patients before we wrap this thing up. 25-year-old coming in, being treated recently for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and would like to discuss contraception. Well, before I say what the next article is, before I say what the main article that I think is important here, I want you all to do me a favor. If you're driving, then don't close your eyes. But if you are not driving or you're doing any other thing in the world, I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to think about the person that you had dinner with last night. Maybe it was your family member. Maybe it was your spouse. Maybe you were just eating by yourself and you had a mirror in front of you looking at yourself. Maybe it was a friend. Maybe it was not a friend at all. Maybe it was just some business partner. I have no idea. Whoever you were eating with, I want you to think about. Do they wear glasses? Do they wear contacts? How do they brush their hair? How do they smell? How do they look? Do they chew their mouth open or closed? Do they get food in their mouth? Do they have a weird nose, a big nose, an odd-shaped nose, blue eyes, green eyes, black eyes? What say you? How did they look? How did they appear? What was it about them that stuck out to you? And with that vision burned in your mind, you can now open your eyes or try to stay back on the road. But with that vision in your mind, I want you to realize that the individual that you just envisioned, the individual that you had dinner with last night, needs to be screened for HIV. The United States Preventive Services Task Force in 2019 is very clear in the fact that everyone, yes, everyone needs to be screened for HIV. And this does not mean everyone that's going to test positive. This doesn't mean everyone that's high risk. It doesn't mean everyone that's low risk. It doesn't mean everyone who could be, maybe have a risk. It means everyone, adults age 15 to 65 years old. Now, the guidelines are very clear that if you are a high-risk individual, then you should be tested more frequently. However, it doesn't say what more frequently means, and it leaves that up to you, the provider. I'm bringing this up because this is an update from 2013. And in 2013, they said the exact same thing. They said, if the person can breathe, if the person has a pulse, then they need to be tested for HIV between the ages of 15 and 65 years old. Except for when we look at CDC data from 2016 to 2017, which is the best data I can find currently to date, 60% of U.S. adults have never had an HIV test. And 70% of people with higher HIV risk have not been tested in the last year. This is super important. We have to test everyone for HIV. And I have talked to some of my colleagues on how can we remember this? How can we do this more often? And the best recommendation I can come up with is when you're doing yearly screening, or if you're doing the first ever evaluation of that individual when they come into your office and you're getting your baseline, whatever blood work you're going to order, whatever it may be, even whether we can argue whether or not you actually need to get blood work, but you're just getting normal baseline stuff on this person. Even if you don't get a CBC, because you know it's probably not indicated, and even if you don't, the person has no complaints, they're doing well, they're really not on any medications, and you don't get a BMP or CMP, because again, it's probably not really indicated, there's one test that you should get, and that is an HIV test. And if it's negative, great. And if it's not negative, then that changes your whole course of action. It changes medications that you give. It changes the way you talk to the patient, not the way you talk to them as in the way you treat them, but the way that ultimately you do treat them with the medications that you will give them. HIV is now a chronic, preventable, really a lifelong disease if we catch it and if we treat it and if we have a compliant patient. When we have PrEP, we have medications, we have all kinds of things that we can talk with our patients about. And speaking of PrEP, remember our patient, the patient I just talked about, this 25-year-old came in with gonorrhea and chlamydia? Well, according to the USPSTF in 2019, this individual should be offered antiretroviral therapy for HIV. Yes, high-risk individuals should be offered PrEP or antiretroviral therapy. Now, they say high risk, and you might be saying to yourself, I don't even know what high risk means. So let's go over what it means, because I think it's really easy when we start to boil it down. High risk is anyone who injects drugs and shares equipment. Duh, that makes sense. High risk is men or women that have sex and a partner has HIV. Duh, that makes sense. High risk is men or women that have sex that have inconsistent condom use and don't know the status, HIV status, of their partner. Duh, that makes sense. And then high risk is men or women that have sex and then have had syphilis or gonorrhea in the past 6 months, with a special caveat being for men that have sex with men, it is the past 6 months with syphilis, gonorrhea, or chlamydia. Men who have sex with men also have chlamydia positive in the last 6 months, makes them high risk. There it is. There you have it. This makes them high risk. And you might be saying, well, this is really nice. This is really wonderful, Andrew, except for my patients, they can't afford it because PrEP's really expensive. And you would be correct. The good news is PrEP is hopefully going to be generic. It is going to be generic at the end of 2020, sometime likely in September. If your patient still wants to get PrEP now, they can. It's a website called Get Your PrEP, G-E-T, Get Your, Y-O-U-R, PrEP, P-R-E-P. It is from the Department of Health and Human Services, and all you have to do is demonstrate that you lack a prescription drug coverage, you've been tested for HIV, and you have a negative result, and that you have a prescription for PrEP, and you, yes you, or your patient, can get PrEP for free. The unbelievable price of $350 free will come to your doorstep or to your patient's doorstep and get them set up with PrEP. Now, let's not forget this 25-year-old patient also wants to talk about birth control or starting contraception. And that brings me to the next paper, the next article of 2019, which is the ACOG committee opinion. The ACOG committee opinion is an update from 2012, and this opinion is on over-the-counter access to hormonal contraception. This is basically the same thing that they said in 2012, but I was not aware of it until just in 2019 when they came out with an updated version of it. Basically, ACOG says, we are the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and we, yes, we, the individuals who control, really, birth control and, you know, giving birth. I know there are some family doctors that do this, but for the most part, it's OBGYNs. We recommend over-the-counter access to hormonal contraception. And that is exactly what it sounds like. You can walk into any pharmacy, CVS, Walgreens, or your mom-and-pop shop on the corner, and I don't care what it is, I'm not paid by any of them, and get over-the-counter access to hormonal contraception. And I first read this article. It's a 7-page article that if you have a chance to read, I would highly recommend. And I thought, this is absolutely brilliant. We are finally giving women a chance to put their hormonal contraception into their own hands. I mean, we don't require men to go get prescriptions for condoms. So why do we require women to go get prescriptions for birth control? I mean, they can just go to the pharmacy and get the medication themselves. I understand we as providers, we as physicians are important, but we're really not that important. We're not so important that the patient needs to come to us in order to get a birth control script, that the patient needs to waste their copay and get a birth control script, that the patient needs to take time out of their day with their kids, with their family, at their home, at their job, just to get a script for birth control. We're really not that important. So this is phenomenal. And what about the young individuals, like our 25-year-old here that is on her parents' insurance, wants to be started on hormonal contraception or birth control, but doesn't want to have the conversation with her parents about her starting birth control? This is an awesome recommendation. And I don't understand why ACOG is the only one coming out and saying, yes, this is what we recommend. I think family physicians, internal medicine physicians, endocrinology, every physician, surgeons, if you're a human being and you know of a woman who takes birth control, you should be saying, we recommend this because it makes so much sense. And then I talked to some of my colleagues, and many of my colleagues were not as positive about this as I was. They said, Andrew, are you kidding me? We can't do this. Do you know that birth control causes clots? Do you know that birth control causes venous thromboembolism? Do you know what will happen if we just allow birth control over the counter? We'll have women walking around with pulmonary embolisms everywhere. They'll have DVTs. It'll be insane. We cannot do this, Andrew. So I said, oh, well, let's dig in a little deeper into how real is the risk of blood clots for hormonal contraception. Well, if you are a non-pregnant, non-contraception-using woman, then your rate of a blood clot per 10,000 years is about 3 in 10,000. If you use birth control, your rate goes up. Your rate skyrockets to 6 per 10,000. If you, for some reason, become pregnant because you couldn't go to the doctor to get your script for your birth control, or that you didn't want to argue with your parents about starting contraception, or you didn't have the money to go to the doctor to get your script for birth control, and you get pregnant, your rates of a clot, of a venous thromboembolism, of a blood clot, go up from 3 to 6 to now 12 per 10,000 women years. And if you become pregnant, there is really only two options in this world. It boils down to two options. Those options are either one, you have an abortion, or two, you deliver the child to birth. Those are really your only two options. And if you deliver the child to birth, your risk of a blood clot in the 12 weeks postpartum is around 53 per 10,000 women years. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, if you believe that we shouldn't have over-the-counter hormonal contraception available for every woman out there, and you believe that we should not be having this because of venous thromboembolism, then that is precisely the reason that you should want over-the-counter access to hormonal contraception. It's not the increase in risk of DVTs and clots with over-the-counter hormonal contraception. It's the decrease risk of clots with over-the-counter hormonal contraception. And with that, we are already right about 20 minutes. So I'm going to end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.